With all that's been happening in the world economy in the last couple of weeks, it seemed appropriate that I should address that subject today, so I was astonished when I picked up the book and it said, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God." And then the story about a master going off to Brindaban without any money and then finding that the divine will fulfilled his every need, really divine coincidence, it doesn't begin to express the combination of forces that made this today's reading. So it really seems an appropriate takeoff point to talk about what's going on in the world, not so much from the point of view of economics or banking or foreclosures or toxic debts or all the other words that we've all been watching. It's already become a little bit of the, this is the world we're living in. It's really quite astonishing how the human being can adapt. When these things first break, it's so startling and exciting, and then after a while, it just becomes the way things are, which is the good news and the bad news both at the same time. I had an experience recently when I was giving a class at East West, and the subject was death, dying, and the astral world. And I gave my usual sort of perky talk about passing over and following Swami Kriyananda's strong emphasis that really nothing happens when we die. We just shed the body and go into the astral world. Yes, it can be lonely for the people on this side who don't have the capacity to still feel or communicate, but nonetheless, our exaggerated sense of tragedy is just exactly that, profoundly exaggerated. And when we ourselves make that transition, as we have done countless times in our many incarnations, we just sort of see that this is just what happens. This is just the way things are. Well, afterwards, I took a lot of questions, and at the end, after everyone else had left, a woman came up to me, and she was intensely unhappy. And even though she had listened attentively and somewhat respectfully, she really wanted me to understand unequivocally that death was a bummer, and that was just that. And she talked about her aunt who had died, and she was in the astral world, and maybe she was in the astral world, and maybe her aunt was fine, but this woman was not fine, and some people might be able to communicate, but she could not. I mean, she just went on and on, and I tried by various means to slip in some perky little thought. Finally, in desperation, sincerely, but desperately, I said, "What can I do for you? What can I do for you?" And I finally realized she just wanted me to understand that she was miserable. So I made what I call sympathetic clucking noises and just, yes, definitely. And just let her declare to me that suffering was the inevitable result of life, and that was the beginning and end of the story. But it was very disconcerting for me, just because I felt sorry for her and I wanted to help her. But I began to think later, in a very complicated, it led me to some really extraordinarily useful thoughts. I began to understand that what her fundamental problem was she didn't have any faith. And we think sometimes of faith, meaning, oh, we have faith in God, Jesus Christ is our Savior, we all go to heaven if we're just good, all these different ways that we define it, which tend to be very external in our thinking. If I do this, then I get that. If I do that, then this happens to me. It's all very mechanical, is what we're thinking. And those definitions of faith are not very satisfactory in the world that we live in. The world that we live in is far too subtle now, with the Hubble telescope sending us back these gorgeous pictures of these extraordinary places, thousands and hundreds of thousands of light years away, and it's just such a big world. And we can travel anywhere, we can be on the internet, we can see so many potentials. It's hard to take these little boxes of God says this, we do that, this happens. The mind just, we're too intelligent, we're too refined these days to think like that. So what's begun to happen is there's been this growing sense of I am the greatest power in the world. And in fact, we have taken a divine truth, which is that God dwells in all, and have made it, well, God then dwells in me. And the operative word becomes me instead of God, and we've begun to make an absolute religion of ego in our world now. In fact, it's sort of considered spiritual to say, well, you can be spiritual and rich and powerful and important, and all this business about having to renounce. You don't have to renounce anything. You can have it all. And the good news is, until quite recently, our world economy has sort of made that seem true, hasn't it? You just buy a house and you just sit there and it just escalates in value and just goes up and up and up and up, and then pretty soon you're old and you're rich. And I was listening to two young men on the radio who had founded one of these. This was a couple of years ago. They dropped out of college to found some company, and after a couple of years they went public with it and they were bazillionaires, maybe just merely millionaires, but they had lots of money, and they were like 26 and 27 years old. And one of the radio announcers was saying, do you think it's a little out of proportion that here you are at this age and you've already earned more money than both your parents ever earned in their entire life? And the young man said, no, not at all. We devoted 2 years of our life to this. there's been a strange double thing going on, which is, on one hand, we've had this expanded sense of awareness of really our own potential. The best-selling DVD last year, The Secret, a very good piece of work, tells you that the power of your own thoughts and your intention, you can manifest anything you want. And there's a lot of truth in it. It's not entirely true, or let's say it's not the complete truth, but there's a tremendous amount of truth in it, and it's a very good direction for people to think. And it's been, as I said, been supported by the economy that we lived in. So we've developed faith. We've developed faith in our own potential to make things happen, which is a step forward. I'm not breaking it down. But also simultaneously, there's been this systematic dismantling of any deep understanding of powers beyond the ego. There's been an increase in a right appreciation of our own responsibility, a moving away from a kind of passive attitude that God will do it and we're just either saved or damned. All of that, very good to throw away. And developing a realistic understanding of what I can do with my own energy. But we've begun to separate ourselves from the greater cosmos. And it's especially self-evident among young people, where because of the way the courts are structured and the way an individual, especially starting at the beginning, when atheists started demanding equal rights in the field of religion. I mean, these are things that right-wing politicians talk about, but you have to understand that self-realization is neither democratic nor republican. And Ananda's always been an enigma because we're not actually liberal in a political sense, where we weave our way through this complex truth, which doesn't really fit into categories. And this whole thing that many people tout as positive, where this atheistic force, primarily by lawsuits, time after time after time after time, has gradually really made it illegal to bring God into any public arena. Because an atheist will be offended, and the atheists have made the courts interpret the law to mean that any mention of God in any public arena is against the Constitution. Well, at first glance, you think, well, okay. But the net result of it is literally, in our public schools, no teacher can mention the word God. You can't have an actual discussion in your class. I see you shaking your head that that's not true. That was true when I went into public schools to teach. That's what I was told. So if I'm slightly wrong in that, that could be wrong. But the fact of the matter is, you cannot bring the idea of faith into a public arena. And our children, our whole culture, are being raised now with this thought that there really is no greater reality. I mean, there was a time when people continued to give lip service to religion, but now soccer matches are on Sunday morning. I mean, nobody imagines that people go to church anymore. It's just not part of our culture. And so children are inundated with information, but they're not given any direction for that information to go. They just goes deeper and deeper into, I can do anything that I want. But you see, the problem is, we can't. Because there's a certain point when there is a power greater than the ego, whether you call it the United States government, the world banking system, the greedy people on Wall Street, which is a ridiculous, the whole thing is so ridiculous to say, he did it, he did it, he did it. What's happening here is so much bigger than any individual can control. When we choose to incarnate at a particular time and place, Master says this, you have your individual destiny, but you also assume the destiny of the whole culture, the destiny of the world at that time. Even a master, who's completely free in himself, once he incarnates in a particular time, place, and culture, he's bound too by what's going on there. That's why the teachings of the masters vary so much. It's because they can only teach to the world that they're living in. Jesus had to teach to the world of the Jews that he was born into. Paramhansa Yogananda, Buddha came and he had to teach to the world of the Hindus that he was born into. Yogananda comes, he teaches into the world of America that he wasn't born into, but that he came to serve. He can talk about a success in business. He can talk about money magnetism. He can advertise. He can talk about individual freedom. It's just all different things. He can talk about Jesus. He can talk about all kinds of things that weren't possible for each of the others. But every individual, especially us, we assume that we're going to be part of this greater destiny. And this greater destiny didn't just start with our generation. Yogananda himself talked about it. He predicted that very difficult times would come to America, to the whole world, but specifically to America. He also said that difficult economic times would come to America, because even though, and Master was extremely pro-America, not in any nationalistic sense, but because of the unique principles upon which this country was founded. Unique in the world, America was founded for religious freedom, for individual freedom, for respect for the individual. That's why those people risked so much to come here. We're about to come to the Thanksgiving celebration, which was the pioneers, the pilgrims, celebrating their survival. They crossed that terrible ocean. They came to this land of nothing at all, and they managed to make it through without all of them dying. It was really an extraordinary thing. The Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with the same inalienable right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. You have to realize how extremely radical that statement was, to say that we were all equal before God, that we all have equal rights in a world in which the rich had rights, the poor didn't have any rights, people still owned one another, and that the entire intention behind it, the founding of this country, is really a thrilling story. And those men were deeply devotional, not necessarily church-going, but they felt that they were acting from some divine destiny to set forward this pattern. And Master said, only in America could self-realization, this movement, have started, because of that freedom of the individual to do whatever he feels is true. Even the fact in America of this enormous proliferation of churches. In Italy, for example, we started out at one point calling Ananda as a movement a church, which we still do to a certain extent in America. But you can't do that in Europe. You don't start churches in Europe. Our Italian friends, it was like the most bizarre concept. There is the church. You don't start other churches. There's just one, and it's the Catholic Church. Everything else is an association, a satsang group, a center, a this or that, but a church, never. You know? But in America, sure, you start churches. Anybody can start churches. You can become a minister over the internet. It takes about 5 minutes. You know? Because, and see, we have to appreciate what that really means. Because every individual in this country is allowed to think and be and do exactly what he feels is true. You can start schools in this country. We tried to start a branch of our school in Germany. The police shut it down. At that time, at least, and I don't want to be inaccurate about this, but the Waldorf school, which was started by a German man, is allowed, and the state schools are allowed. But you can't just take your children and educate them any way you want, because lots of things could happen if you do that. But in America, you're allowed to do that, because we are allowed to be exactly who we are. So people arrive in this country. I mean, here we have Barack Obama, who is mixed race, and I guess he was illegitimate when he was conceived, you know? I believe that. Were his parents married? I can't even remember whether his parents were married or not. But he's quite a story when you think of it from that point of view. And you have immigrants who came, Henry Kissinger, arrived, Arnold Schwarzenegger, You know, these people come in. He comes in as a muscle man from nowhere. Right? He becomes a movie star. Then he's the governor of California. He would be president if he were native born, or at least he'd be trying hard. You know, just like... But really think about this. Think about this in terms of the long history of oppression by the upper class and so on. And so it's a fantastic story. What I'm trying to say is America is a Dwapara Yuga country. It's for the new age. It's a whole new reality. And I know that it's true that the masters had a great hand in the founding of this country. All of that was all to say that master is very big on America for very good reasons. A friend of ours from South America pointed out once, he said, American, historically, you know, America's, I think, the second oldest continuous government in the world, which is really an awful thing to say. I mean, the same system that hasn't just been overthrown and started. I feel really weak on historical facts today, so you can correct me on that one later. But our friend from South America said South America was founded for gold, and it's been nothing but turmoil, whereas America was founded for religious freedom. You see, there's divine laws at play here. We can't just with impunity just throw this thing and that thing aside. But this is what I was wanting to say. Yogananda said America has very good karma. We're very idealistic. We've been very generous in the way we've dealt with the whole world. We're very generous in our attitudes. We're fundamentally a very spiritual nation. But he said we have a little bad karma. And that bad karma was the American Indians and the black people we enslaved. And that's been a bad karma that's been set in place. Now, both of those, interestingly, were economic. That was the reason why we did those, because it made us richer. Those poor Indians were just in the way of our becoming wealthy and successful. And we'd give them land, and then we'd discover oil on it, so we'd move them off of that. You know, we'd give them this land, we'd discover gold on it, so we'd move them off of that. It was a horrible blot on our history. And the black slavery, of course, was also equally so. So Master said that that karma sort of lurks and has to be expiated because there was a certain aberration in our establishment of our economic success that has to be balanced against all the generosity of the American people, but nonetheless that karma lurks. So we come in and we get to be Americans, you know, and we're so peppy and we can make things happen and we have so much money, but this karma is still lurking back there. And then simultaneously, you see, on the whole planet at this time, I think the word greed, which I think is one of the seven deadly sins, am I correct in that? Anyway, greed is like not a good thing. And greed has like crept into the system a little bit. You know, the amount of stuff that we have, the lavish way we live, our consumption of resources, and there's really no reason. It's not that we should be impoverished. There's no great spirituality to being hungry, you know. I went to India. I remember one of the times I was just walking in this marketplace in India. There's a very, very old woman selling garlic by the clove. I don't mean by the bulb. I mean by the single clove of garlic. I mean the economy was at such a level that she made her living selling one at a time, which was like enough for her to go, you know, and buy a little bit of rice. But also there was somebody else who could only afford to buy garlic one clove at a time. I mean, we don't even begin to realize, you know, the lavish level on which we live. But we've earned it. But nonetheless, it's very out of balance. And did we really think that the wave only goes up? I mean, just stand back for just a moment. Think of the tiniest little bit you know about anything. Does the wave only go up? Now, here we are. We're right in the middle of this. And whether or not, you know, things will continue, whether the past, the future will look a great deal like the past, or whether there's going to be some readjustment one way or another, now it's beholden upon us. You know, as individuals, like, how are we going to deal with this? And I'm coming back now to this woman that I was talking about at East West and faith and what the whole concept is. What I realized was happening to her, which was totally insoluble for me to solve it, was she simply did not believe that there is any overarching good purpose going on in this world. You see, that's what faith really is. It's not any form of God. It's this deeply held inward belief that the resolution of this story is bliss. And this is how Swamiji writes about it. This is how Master talked about it a great deal of time. There's this wonderful word, Sat Chit Anandam, ever existing, ever conscious, ever new joy. In the definition of what Ananda believes in, we believe in this all-pervading Sat Chit Anandam, and that Sat Chit Anandam is the substance of creation, and the purpose of our lives is to realize that within ourselves, and our inevitable destiny, is that we will come to know ourselves as Sat Chit Anandam. All optimism in life, all positive feeling, all ability to rise again from the ashes, whatever those ashes have been created by, is some deeper than conscious knowing within ourselves that the nature of reality is ever existing, ever conscious, ever new bliss. From joy I came, for joy I live, in sacred joy I melt. Now, nobody promises that the road to that is going to be without obstacles, because we have this hard-edged ego self that has false ideas about reality. We can assert these false ideas as much as we want. But I've given 2 years of my life. I deserve to be a millionaire. Of course that's right. I mean, okay, so the man earned a lot of money and had very good karma and was very lucky. I'm not wanting him to not have it. But really, you know, let's just expand a quarter of an inch beyond this narrow tunnel in which we're living and imagine a greater reality than just my own thoughts and just sort of see life in perspective. Swami Kriyananda was at the dinner table once with his own relatives. And one of his family was just talking about someone with a great deal of money and how they were spending all that money essentially on themselves. And Swami, just without even thinking, said, I just can't imagine having that much money and just spending it on yourself. And his mother said, now that's a very interesting point of view. And Swami later, he didn't say anything to her at the time, but later he said, how could there be another point of view? Because in the world in which he lives, yes, of course you provide for yourself, you provide for those who rely upon you, you may live in a gracious style if your energy and karma has brought it to you, but after that, in the principles of Ananda Sangha, this world is bound together by an indissolvable web of mutual service one to another. That's really why we're here, and it's not because there's this God forcing us to do it. It's because it's more blessed to give than to receive. It's more blissful. It is our true nature. That's the key to tuning in to that Sat Chit Anandam, is to see ourselves as part of this greater whole. Now, we're either, and I often joke about this, the way spiritual growth happens is one of two ways. Either we're sitting here and we see this beautiful vision of light, and without a thought we drop everything and run to that light. Or we're sitting here just enjoying the moment, and then all of a sudden our fanny catches fire, right? And all of a sudden we're being burned from the back, so we start running forward, you know, in the direction to try to get away from that. And the fact of the matter is, we have to go forward, we have to grow, both individually, as a nation, karma has to be fulfilled. Now, it seems that America is a little out of balance economically. I mean, we just look at this world around us. We're having to run faster and faster and faster and faster just to stay even. And it isn't really very much fun. You know, people are getting this terrible sense of inescapable strain and not knowing how to stop it. You know, companies are downsizing but expecting you to do the same amount of work. So many people who are interested in spiritual things, I finally figured out it's not that they're not interested, it's that they just don't have the time. You know, between the 14 lessons the children take and your own career and your husband's work and the necessity to take care of the house, pant, pant, you know, you just can squeeze out this little tiny piece for God. But I don't think that this is the way we are meant to live. But sometimes when God performs an operation, there's a lot of blood. You know? And whether this is the moment or not, sooner or later, individually and collectively, we're going to have to come back into balance. And this is the time to cultivate faith. And I don't mean faith that, oh, I won't get laid off. You know, maybe you will, maybe you won't. Oh, I'll be able to meet my mortgage payments. Maybe you will, maybe you won't. You know, God doesn't promise us a comfortable ride. The faith we need to cultivate is this deeply held belief that I am not in charge of this world, that there is a greater power than my own ego, and that power loves me. And therefore, whatever happens to me in this life is done to me in the name of love for a divine purpose that as I rise to understand it, I too will embrace as for my own highest good. Now that is a very tall order, and we don't get there just by saying, oh yeah, you know, my beloved mother died and she's in the astral world. Isn't that swell? You know, we just don't get there just like that. You have to practice when it's easier. And we have received a great big warning bell with all that's going on with our economy right now that things may not proceed as normal. So if we are relying upon our strength, for our strength, upon everything just staying in place, maybe we'll get away with it, maybe we won't. But there's a big warning bell that we really need to cultivate our inner experience of the beneficent, loving presence of the infinite. Now, I've quoted to you before, but I want to bring it up in this context. If you go through our little schoolroom back here, you see two little charts, practicing kindness, choosing happiness, that the children, and all the children's names there. And there's all their names, and then there's little stickers. Naturally, when one looks at that, one thinks that some children practice kindness more, and they're going to have more stickers, and others choose happiness, and they're going to have more stickers. But the thing is confusing, because every child has exactly the same number. Well, first of all, you could see if they got stickers for practicing kindness, well, you might develop sincere character, but the chance of developing hypocrisy is so great that it was just an appalling idea, really. But what's actually happening there, as Barbara explained it to me, is that she is teaching the children to observe positive acts in the environment around them. In other words, to pay attention to the good. And every time a child comes back and reports that so-and-so did this well, so-and-so chose happiness, so-and-so practiced kindness, then everybody celebrates together. And then they all put a sticker by their name because good things have happened in this world. And a great deal of our despair when it happens to us is because we've just chosen to forget every good thing that ever happened and look this way. I remember once when something very difficult was going on for this individual, I said, has God always taken care of you in every circumstance? Because I knew it was true. I knew she'd had miraculous things. Yes. I said, why do you think suddenly he's not going to come through? You know, why this one time? Why, after all that you know? But you see, the habit of the mind, and Swami puts it this way, always be solution-oriented, not problem-oriented. Just watch our minds. Just watch how many good things happen, but this one we know is going to be different. You know, it's always worked out, but not this time. Or, you know, each time it's with your arms folded, prove it to me again. I mean, it's not a very magnetic attitude. You know, we need to develop faith, not based on dogma, not based on anybody's opinion, but based on your actual, conscientious, careful, consistent observation of your own experience. Is this life really a pointless nothing in which I'm the last word? Oh my God, we have problems now, don't we? You know, if we only had to rely on ourselves, or have we again and again observed that even in the most difficult circumstances, there is this other force that if we flow with it, and especially if we flow with it courageously and joyously, always takes us to a place even that we couldn't imagine. You know, even in the most difficult times, because I think myself, as I say, whether or not this is the final cataclysmic moment in which everything changes, or whether we look back and this was just one of many, who knows? But it is a wake-up call, friends. You know, where does our happiness come from? What do we really believe is true? How much energy are we putting into those things that will last? Jyotish, last week, he was giving service in Portland where we were, and he said, when you come to Ananda, he said, you may not have, when he was talking about moving, especially to Ananda Village, and he was talking about parental upset when we were all young and we threw away our promising careers and just went into this hippie ashram is what it looked like at the time. And he said, but we had to just look at it honestly and say, and it's still true. If we give our lives to God, we may not have all those things that money can buy, but we'll have all those things that money can't buy. And we may not have the money to buy them anyway soon, so. But really, it is a very serious question. What do you really want? You know, what do we really want? Where does our happiness come from? What do we really believe is true? And how soon are we going to get serious about that? You know, are we going to go forward toward the light because we know that Satchitananda is our destiny? Are we going to just sit on this chair until the last bit of it is just in flames and we have to start running? You see, karma only hits you hard if you resist it. If you just move with it, I feel personally that all of us who are part of a spiritual path, even if economic catastrophes come, you know, we just don't live so much in that world. We enjoy it, why not? But it's not the definition of who we are. But the more deeply we have integrated that into ourselves, the more the karma will be mitigated because the lesson will be learned. You see? The only point of a hard lesson is because we resist it. If you learn it quickly, it's all over. You know, if you say to the child, you have to clean up your room or you're not going to be able to go out and play, it only becomes a trauma if the child refuses to clean up his room. If he just goes in and says, which he never does, all right, mommy, I'll just go clean up my room. Then he goes out and plays. There's nothing to it. If God says to us, oh, I'm going to change all your circumstances. I'm going to take away all your external sense of security. I'm going to change the whole paradigm in which you're living. And we say, all right, Divine Mother, if that's what you want. Right? Yes, I know it's going to be a lot of work. I was planning to do something else. I had other plans. But, well, if this is what you want, this is what I'll do. Where's the trauma? The trauma is in no, no, no. Little Brian, when he was very small once, Gary's son, Gary brought him up. He was about 2 years old. He carried him up like this and brought him up to be blessed. Gary, you know, Brian's a grown man now. But I don't know what was in his mind. But he came up, I think, to me to be blessed. And he saw me. He put his hands over his forehead. And he just started twisting in his father's arms. No, 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 no. I was completely charmed by his sincerity, if nothing else. You know? But honey, this is really for your own good. You know, how shall we relate to Divine Mother? Shall we put our hands over our head and wiggle in our father's arms and say, no, no, no? Or we say, okay, I may not like it, I may not even enjoy it, but I trust you. That's the only way to approach it, friends. Bless you.
Silence.